Well, very good to see all of you again this evening, and some new faces, and I'm very sorry that not everyone came back, but it's great to see so many of you. To another discussion of international law and the art of peace, and finally we're going to get to the art today, at least more properly art than art in the sense of how we do things in a broader sense. Remember that lecture one concerned a core substantive, or I would say the core substantive rule of international law for preserving the peace, the prohibition on aggression. Lecture two concerned the many methods of peaceful resolution of disputes that we have available to us as alternatives to resort to major military force for resolving conflicts and achieving certain goals. I also offered some conclusions toward the end of the talk yesterday from international legal process theory about how we can properly formulate our thinking or certain helpful principles within dispute resolution methods to make those methods more successful. And you'll recall that I suggested that international law looked at deeply and widely and over time indicates that we have an overarching principle of decision, a guide to judging, for example, our highest norm being the norm of peace. And I also said that international legal process theory suggests that we have a principle for guiding the actual operation, the effective operation of IDR methods, and that is legality. Both legality in the pursuit of the goal by a method and in how the method is actually operated. And third, I said there was a principle from international dispute resolution or international legal process theory about succeeding with these methods, a way to support the methods being knowledge. Knowledge of the facts, knowledge of the law, and I'm sad to say increasingly we seem not in our international community to have the knowledge of international law that we need. Knowledge of the range and methods of solutions that are available, and knowledge that we can gain, for example, from social science research on what methods are effective for what kinds of problems. Today's topic is focused on improving compliance with international law, both those substantive rules and also the procedures. And I want to start, and I'll go ahead and put up today's slide and talk a little bit about the selected image for today. I wanted to talk about both. We'll start out, as has generally been the practice, with some discussion of the current situation, some definitions, and some just foundational ground laying. And then we'll move to something that is quite new, I think, in our field generally. That's not an exaggeration. But an idea I believe has a lot of promise and that I think will be very exciting for many of us to work on in the future, and that's aesthetic theory. Since that is so new, I just came up with it a few months ago, I've selected this iPad artwork by David Hockney. And if you got to see his 2012 show, this was one of these monumental pieces of art that he produced with his iPad and a phenomenal printer. And you walked into the gallery space and you felt you were walking into this luminous space of mountains, clouds, and so on. So it's very high tech, very recent. Hockney, of course, British, but having lived so long in the United States, I feel I can claim a little bit of connection to him. And nevertheless, despite things that might make us feel the cold, hard reality of alienating technology of our consumer times, it actually overwhelms with beauty. So that's why I chose the Hockney for today. Beginning, though, with what we already know about attraction, and attracting compliance with international law. We have a couple of different theories about why states already comply and what will make states, international organizations, the individuals that are bound by rules of international law comply better. One of the first people to talk about compliance with international law, and he wrote a book called Improving Compliance with International Law, was Harvard's Roger Fisher. He's very well known for his book, Getting to Yes, which is the Bible for all negotiators. He was actually, in his training and in his teaching, not often known, a professor of international law at Harvard. And he, after writing Getting to Yes, an early version of that, in 1981, he wrote Improving Compliance with International Law. And he makes the case in the book that the real key to getting compliance with rules of international law is that those rules are clear, straightforward, open, and available to the understanding of the leaders of government and so forth who have to accomplish the compliance, that it is clear that they know what they have to do, and that it is a legitimate rule that broadcasts its legitimacy because the rule came through the accepted authoritative processes of international law. It is clearly from treaty. It is clearly from custom. It is a provable general principle. So that was the basis of Fisher's argument. A few years later, Tom Frank really mirrored that, somewhat different language, but basically the same idea. Perhaps putting more emphasis than Fisher did on the coming through the need for the pedigree of a legal rule to have this pull of compliance. And they both suggested in their writing that the more we did to clarify, to make clear that the rule came through an authoritative source, the more likely those bound to comply would do so. I have incorporated both of those ideas in a new book chapter on the Security Council. Australia has had a 3-year process going on of how to reform the Security Council as part of what they offered to do if they were elected to the Security Council, which they were. And Hillary Charlesworth and Jeremy Farrell are overseeing a large book with these contributions. So I took as mine how to improve the Security Council's compliance with international law. And I thought about the fact that the Security Council both could do a better job of complying with international law itself, and it could, by doing so, model law compliance and be an example, a very prominent example that could be cited in helping to persuade others to comply with international law. So in preparing that book chapter, I had access, of course, to Ellie Lauterpacht's own Lauterpacht lectures on the aspects of administration of international justice. And Ellie points out that the Security Council is a quasi-judicial body and that it is making law-like and binding decisions. It has this very fundamental capacity to bind. It has a very fundamental compulsory jurisdiction in its area of responsibility for peace and security. We were talking yesterday about new courts and new ways of bringing about rulings and development of the law through authoritative sources, and especially through compulsory jurisdiction. We talked about the WTO and its wide jurisdiction, and the Law of the Sea Tribunal, the International Court of Justice, mandatory arbitration. But we also have the Security Council modeling both its, that we appreciate, that we support compulsory jurisdiction. But if the Security Council is going to be a quasi-judicial body with compulsory jurisdiction, then I think it's all the more important for the Security Council to acknowledge and to comply with the rules binding on it in carrying out its role in this quasi-judicial fashion. So I suggested, for example, that the Security Council has never really acknowledged a point I think is indisputable, that when it is authorizing a use of force, it must comply with the jus ad bellum rules itself. I mean, it has the opportunity to decide if there's a basis for resort to force. But there are other principles in addition to the basis for force that apply to all uses of force under the jus ad bellum. So the Security Council, before it authorizes, should do an assessment of necessity. It should do an assessment of whether military force is going to be proportionate to the goal that the parties wish to accomplish. And the Security Council must take into account rules of responsibility, either state responsibility or international organization responsibility. I believe these are all binding on it, and that it should give reasons or explain in its resolutions how it is compliant with those rules in the way that a court would do, give its reasoning. There's an excellent article, recent article by Anna Spain Bradley of the University of Colorado Boulder on the Security Council's obligation to decide and duty to decide. And I think her most persuasive argument is the Security Council's duty under new international legal process principles to give reasons for what it's doing. And I would say those reasons have to include its compliance with the binding international law. So in addition to giving those reasons in its resolutions, it would be a helpful step for the whole international community if the Security Council would revise its rules of procedure to make it clear that it is bound by international law, relevant international law to its actions, and including these important rules limiting jus ad bellum. It could also, if it has any doubts about this, of course it could ask the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion about the law governing the Security Council's own actions. The Security Council, interestingly, has only asked for one advisory opinion. We know of many important advisory opinions asked for by the General Assembly and even other organs of the United Nations, but only one by the Security Council. So I think this is a failure to use a great resource that would model resort to the International Court of Justice and concern and interest in complying with international law. I'd also like to see all Security Council member staffs receive annual training in the jus ad bellum. They could go to the UN University and have courses taught by Professor Christine Gray and learn very important details. I mean, these countries rotate in and out. They don't necessarily, why would they have that kind of level of education of jus ad bellum that Security Council members should have? So some ways that the Security Council could both ensure its own compliance and model compliance with international law. In addition to clear rules properly adopted and modeled, Harold Coe has written about another way that we have an international law for ensuring compliance and drawing in compliance. He has stressed in his own work on legal process that the important thing is to internalize international law. So I assume he means in the corporate body of our governments or the leadership of our international organizations. He particularly stresses the need to internalize by using national court and judicial and legal processes. So he believes that those of us who want to see international law complied with should bring cases in national courts. And of course, that's another very effective way. In the power and purpose of international law, I talked centrally about another means that's essential for, I believe, winning compliance with international law. I'm not sure that this is one we have to do more of, but certainly knowledge of it would not hurt. And that is the system of coercion or the sanctioning system for law violations. As Kelsen taught, we have sanctions within international law. He referred to them as war and reprisals. We still have the right to use force in self-defense, for example, which would be a way of enforcing the obligation on states not to attack unlawfully under Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the UN Charter. but more importantly, the general method of enforcement that attaches to every rule of international law is the countermeasure. This is not widely known, it seems surprising to me, but every rule of international law is backed by a sanction. In an old-fashioned John Austinian sense of the word, and it is that coercive potential attaching to a rule of international law that distinguishes a legal rule from a mere soft law guideline or a moral principle or a principle of courtesy. So it is an essential part of every legal rule that the potential to enforce it coercively exists. This is the signal, and this potential, as H.L.A. Hart said, does factor into why any state would comply with its obligations under international law or organization or individual. But also, as H.L.A. Hart says, no system of law can depend on the coercion system for getting the kind of compliance and getting the level of compliance necessary to really have a functioning legal system. It's important for those few actors who will not comply voluntarily and for those others who are nervous about the ones who don't want to be left the fool because they complied and the other guy didn't. So knowing the potential for coercion, and of course that potential being raised in people's minds by the occasional use of the coercive sanction, is in my view a critical part of how international law is enforced and how it wins compliance in international relations. I think we're moving ever more toward improvements in the system of coercion because of the increase in international institutional possibilities of judging and refining and awarding the sanction. So, of course, the WTO, with its very rich now jurisprudence on countermeasures, has been very helpful in refining and creating a much more law-like and acceptable form of sanction. But as I've already said, we've got this rising number of courts, all with the ability to impose penalties, to shape sanctions, and to make visible for the international community that there are sanctions for failing to comply with international law. Now, of course, people regularly say to me, but they're weak sanctions. They hardly ever happen. And then I say to them, and I live near Chicago, where I'm sure we have a law against murder. It has been violated hundreds of times in the past year, with no possibility of the perpetrators ever being brought to justice, ever. I mean, they have arrested maybe a handful of the perpetrators of hundreds. What is it this year? 300, 400 people murdered. There will be over 100 people murdered last year in my small town of South Bend. And they will arrest maybe 3 or 4. But I don't say there's no law against murder. I want it to be improved, for sure. But we know the potential is there. We want to see law enforcement, and we keep the sense that we have law by that potential, if not by the reality of actually stopping or decreasing the murder rate or catching even a majority of the murderers. So this is a problem for all law. Uniformity with which and the precision with which the sanctioning system, the enforcement system works. And we really shouldn't be over-concerned, we in international law, that our system doesn't work better. Of course, we want it to be improved, but it's not really the heart and soul of international law or even getting compliance with international law. So I'm not really very reliant on or even very concerned about the enforcement system or improving the enforcement system. I'm actually quite satisfied with the system we have in international law, but I'm not satisfied with compliance with international law. I'm particularly not satisfied with I would like to see the law against the use of force being complied with at a much better rate than the murder the law against murder in Chicago. Since 1945, according to Sharif Bassiouni, there have been over 300 major armed conflicts, which means there have been over 300, that was as of 2010, in violation of the UN Charter. And for somebody like me, who cares very much about ending war and the devastation that it brings, this is a very, very unfortunate statistic. So how can we improve compliance with that law, with Article 2, Paragraph 4? And I've been thinking quite a bit about how to do this, and probably also I was open to thinking in a new way, because after many years working in the field of international law and the use of force, it seemed to me that my colleagues, my students, were finding it ever more interesting to focus on how to get around the rules against the use of force. Certainly since 9/11, there's been a new attitude in the United States, and I believe it is spreading to other countries, and I think it's true of here in the United Kingdom, but maybe also in places that are truly surprising to me, like Germany, that there would be an interest among students and colleagues to reinterpret Article 51, for example, restricting resort to force and self-defense, to find more loopholes and more ability to use force. I was particularly shocked last September when our United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, a longtime member of the Harvard Law Faculty, a specialist in international human rights law, was interviewed on National Public Radio on September 9th, and was asked by, it was asked a question I don't think I'd ever heard an American interviewer ask. Would it be lawful for the United States to attack Syria in the circumstances after the finding of the use of chemical weapons? And Ambassador Power said it would be legitimate. And she was heavily lobbying for the Congress to authorize the president to use military force against Syria and to carry out an attack. So that was our ambassador to the UN, who I think at least understood it would not be lawful, because she didn't use that term. She didn't answer, yes, it would be lawful. She said it would be legitimate. And so she didn't seem to have an inhibition about violating the UN Charter in terms of legality. She thought this legitimacy overrode or was in place of. And that really has bothered me very deeply. What has happened to the UN Charter and to our rules supporting peace and to our sense of respect and value of law, that it is so easy and very little pushback, certainly not by the interviewer, that the United States act in disregard of such prominent and important law? Law that, as we discussed earlier days, the United States played a significant role in helping to draft. So I thought, okay, there has to be another way of trying to bring the sense of majesty, this sense of importance, the sense of attraction to how we talk about law and how we present it, how at least some people might begin to think about it again, to recapture something of that feeling that we discussed yesterday, the peace movements who were so passionate about building the rule of law, finding alternatives to war. They had such a extraordinary belief in law and such a profound dread and hatred of war. But as I discussed yesterday, we lost that popular support. We don't have that in international law anymore for peace against the use of force. So what can we put in place that might give it some of that same renewal and sense of attraction? And what could I begin to think about that would renew myself so that I, after these many years, especially since 9/11, where the life of an international lawyer who's particularly respectful of the UN Charter, of the Convention Against Torture, of the Geneva Conventions, has been a really troubling and difficult one. So I thought I needed some renewal myself and a sense that there might be a more positive way to go. And I really had these thoughts. I began teaching international art law after the U.S. invasion of Iraq because of the failure to protect Iraqi cultural sites. And I was already teaching use of force, so we were talking about that aspect of the occupation. And I developed a whole international art law course out of that, and we used Roger O'Keefe's book, of course. I'm sorry he's not here for his book. But I've gone on now to be teaching that course every other year. And in international art law, which Nino took, right, we talk a lot about why we value art, and what is it about art, and the amazing draw that art has. I mean, it's one of the things I really recall we talked about, that normal law-abiding people, this isn't going to help my story, but normal law-abiding people who would never take a pound note that they, well, there aren't anymore, right, a 10-pound note they find lying somewhere, would buy a work of art without provenance, without knowing it had been stolen. I mean, we're all aware of this, right? This is big news in the international law world that there's a lot of stolen art in the wrong hands. But people are, the amazing ability of art, that people want to possess it, they want to see it, they want to create it, is so strong. It may be stronger than the allure and the glamour of war. So I began thinking there might be something through art. And in international art law, we think about the relationship between art and law. And we begin the seminar thinking about the contrasts. In art, this is a quote from Merriman, one of the leading international art law thinkers, ethics and law. And he says, in art, we value the creative act, the gesture that transcends boundaries, defines conventions, and breaks the rules. So art and law appear to be antithetical. Yet, I think we found in our course that they're really much more in symbiosis. To work, artists need the social peace created by law. Artists can earn income because of the commercial system and property concepts established by law. And in turn, art inspires lawyers to insight and creativity in working through the law for the common good. Artistic work reflects humanity's capacity, and so does law. So from these seminar discussions, I've been thinking about how we might apply the artistic insight into solving a particular problem of law, the problem of compliance. We know, we've just been talking about this, the struggle, why isn't there compliance? Why doesn't Samantha Power want to comply with the UN Charter? International law is law that governs humanity at the global level. It's the law that restricts the right to resort to war. It's the law that is relevant to protecting human rights, and the law that actually supports the prohibition on the use of chemical weapons, the same prohibition that Samantha Power wanted to enforce by breaking the law. The challenges of war, human rights abuse, poverty, and environmental degradation must fundamentally have solutions at the global level if humanity is to flourish in the future. And to provide effective solutions, international law simply requires a higher level of compliance. As I said, Fisher explained that one reason some rules are obeyed but not others is owing to characteristics of a rule. Is it clearly expressed? Has it been adopted through right process? Has it been created through the right process, through an appropriate process? These are characteristics that I suggest to you are the beginning of an aesthetic theory of law. Are there ways that we can better craft rules to enhance the pull and attraction to compliance? What can we learn about what attracts us to art that might be useful in how we think about law? Is there something in human nature that responds to works of art as beautiful or moving that could be applied to our thinking, talking, working through the law. Are there modes of art education that could be adapted to legal education? Aesthetic theory and the philosophy of aesthetics is being used in many adjunct fields, such as theology, to try to raise people's sense of awe, inspiration, and involvement with the ideas. But as far as I can tell, until now, not really with law. I read one of my colleagues at Notre Dame had really made me begin to think this is a possible new opening for us to improve international law because of his book, The Many Faces of Beauty. He's a philosopher, Vittorio Husserl, and he has a series of chapters by mathematicians, by anthropologists, by philosophers, by artists, real artists who create art. The chapter that moved me the most was one by a theologian, Cyril Regan. The very last sentence says, "A theology without beauty is not persuasive." And I think we could say that about law. Law without beauty is not persuasive. Why do it? If it's not pursuing the beautiful, why engage? It's not persuasive. Why would we expect to persuade people to comply with any law, let alone international law, without it? The disappointment of the book is that there was a chapter by a lawyer, a law professor from Germany, but he didn't talk about aesthetics. He didn't talk about beauty and the study of beauty and what beauty is and how it works through our other disciplines, how mathematicians look for beauty in formulas, how brain scientists are now understanding how we perceive the beautiful. It was a nice chapter. I enjoyed it. He used pictures to show how through history artworks have been used to illustrate the law. And that's fine, but I think we can do so much more. So one of the examples he gave is Raphael's beautiful painting of the marriage of Mary and Joseph. And the author says that this was done in order to illustrate and to make popular a major change in church teaching about marriage, that it would now be the church's position that people should consent to marry, and that they should have this opportunity, and that's what Raphael's painting. Well, that's good. We could, I could have talked to you today, shown you Guernica, and said, this is why we should not go to war. And I think that's a possible use of art and the study of beauty. But I think there is already so much more in the literature on aesthetics that I want to discuss with you that could help us in international law with this problem. I've only found one major article or one lawyer, law professor working in this area who's produced a certain body of work, and that's a legal philosopher also at the University of Colorado, Boulder, Pierre Schlag, or he was there. I think he's actually moved to the East Coast somewhere. And he has some interesting work on how the way people picture the law in their mind, they think in a grid, or if they think in a far more open pattern, that reflects how they will reason through the law. And he doesn't like people who think in grids. He finds them too constrained. He's an open thinker. And I'm not sure we need any more open thinking in international law. But so he's got some interesting work. But I'm going to talk about two other possibilities for the use of aesthetics by those of us in international law. I'm going to first talk about some of the scientific findings and then just give you an indication of what's being done in science about the perception of beauty and how it works on us and our brains and our perception. And then I'll talk about philosophy of aesthetics, especially the subset of philosophy of aesthetics known as aesthetic ethics. And yes, it's really hard to say in English. I want to just have a little water so I can say it better next time. Mm-hmm. So in Vittorio Husserl's book, The Many Faces of Beauty, Mario Livo talks about symmetry in the science of symmetry and what we've learned about the fact that symmetry is our core concept related to our perception of beauty. And Livio says that Birkhoff proposed a formula for the feeling of aesthetic value. M equals O slash C. And the formula means that for a given degree of complexity, the aesthetic measure is higher the more order the object possesses. So the more complex, the more orderly, the more beautiful. And if you remember, I think that the first illustration, which has a great deal of complexity, but it is very orderly, and this is also true of Islamic art, which doesn't have representational depiction but design. Some of the most beautiful art in the world is Islamic art with its patterns that are complex and carefully ordered, and they appear to us so beautiful. Alternatively, if the amount of order is specified, the aesthetic measure is higher the less complex the object is. Since for the most practical purposes, the order is determined primarily by the symmetries of the object, Birkhoff's theory heralds symmetry as a crucial aesthetic element. And then Livio goes on to say, and we see this symmetry principle again in music, some of the most beautiful music that has repeating symmetrical constructions. And for our purposes, thank goodness, in at least poetry, but maybe also in other literature, so that there are different ways we can take advantage of this scientific understanding of symmetry in the words we use, in the way we construct language about law, that this might have attraction, that we can do this way. And probably many of you already knew this. My husband told me this several years ago. He works in photography, and he often he's an expert on Photoshop, so he's often asked by magazines, like Vogue and so forth, to check their layouts. And the principal way that we identify the beautiful person, do you all know this? You do. The symmetry of their faces. It's crazy. Symmetry is in perception of human beauty. Preferences for symmetry have evolved probably for a variety of reasons. This is Livio. The important point is, however, that there is a preference for symmetry. Symmetry plays a crucial role in animal mate selection. The area of the brain, we know this from brain science, that responds to beauty has been identified. And the more symmetrical, the more it lights up. For a long time, it's been assumed that the criteria for beauty are largely cultural and therefore learned. This is probably my favorite point of all tonight, and not innate. But recent psychological studies have shown that this point about symmetry is true regardless of culture. We, across cultures, perceive the same faces as beautiful. We have that kind of universality in our very beings as human beings. That means that we can work with that aspect of knowing and our way of being because we have the scientific knowledge. And it also makes me feel, one of the classic arguments against international law is that we don't share common culture. How can we share common law? But obviously, we have the ability to share a great deal of common culture, and of course, certain works of art, Islamic art, Chinese art, works of the Renaissance, are universally perceived as beautiful. You can have and do have, I think, sufficient common culture for the law. So there's some possibilities there in science, and certainly around the science of symmetry and aesthetics, but perhaps even more possibilities in the area of philosophy of aesthetics, and especially the subcategory of ethics. Aesthetic ethics refers to the idea that human conduct and behavior ought to be governed by that which is beautiful and attractive. These ideas, that particular core idea and definition, is from a long philosophical history that is traced back canonically to Aristotle, who famously in his Poetics took issue with Plato that poetry was not worthy. And one of Aristotle's defenses of poetry was that it is beautiful. He didn't say much more, but he gave permission to every philosopher after him to be concerned with and interested in beauty, and maybe international orders too. And so philosophers have, through the generations, asked, what is beautiful? Aristotle didn't tell them. And how does it relate to ethics? Kant has, of course, a beautiful essay, The Analytic of the Beautiful, in which he delves into and overcomes a long resistance to thinking understanding of beauty was important. He thought it was subjective and not objective, and he came through years before this brain science to think that there is an objective understanding of beauty, and he defined the way we see beauty and understand beauty as that which gives pleasure for no practical purpose. So he would distinguish, so food gives you pleasure, but that also has a very practical purpose. Whereas if you view the Hockney and you're finding it beautiful and pleasurable to look at, it hasn't needed to do you any practical good, right? That was Kant's test for beauty. And more recently, and then Kant says that this is universally perceivable, this idea of beauty, and he says that it is common sense, that beauty is common sense. It is a thing that we commonly all sense. So, but probably the contemporary philosopher who is most associated these days, although problematically, with aesthetics is Theodor Adorno, the German philosopher, post-Second World War critical thinker. I particularly was interested in reading Adorno, or trying to, because he's also a philosopher who made a very strong argument after the Second World War for the need to return in our postmodern period to natural law because of the Nazi use of positive law for evil ends, with no way to prevent that in the legal system without a natural law limitation. And in addition, Adorno is very interested in cultural world, in aesthetics, in the philosophy of Kant and in Hegel, and how they thought about beauty and the role of beauty in our post-modern world. And he is credited with this idea of arguing for art as an antidote to alienation, although sadly it didn't help him to overcome a deep pessimism. So, but Kant, Adorno, and other philosophers who've given rise to contemporary ethics are being looked to for ideas about how to live the beautiful life, to create beautiful law, to one area where there's a great deal being done with aesthetics is in peace education. John Dewey has pointed out that the unity of aesthetics and ethics is in fact reflected in our understanding of behavior being fair. And he's thinking about that in terms of peace education, but of course fairness is the anchor of all law. And so to infuse this idea and to raise it in our thinking about international law by looking to aesthetics, I think could be very helpful to us. More recently, the Australian anthropologist James Page has suggested that aesthetic ethics might be taken to form a philosophical rationale for peace education. I think it could form a philosophical rationale for international law. Since fairness is the measure of law and its anchor, aesthetic ethics could equally provide a rationale for law, especially international law, because international law, of course, is disconnected with other grounding that national law has, for example, in the myth of the social contract. Page further suggests that peace education be thought of as encouraging a commitment to peace as a settled disposition and enhancing the confidence of the individual as an individual agent of peace, as informing the student on the consequences of war and social injustice, as informing the student on the value of peaceful and just social structures, and working to uphold or develop such social structures, as encouraging the student to love the world and to imagine a peaceful future, and as caring for the student and encouraging the student to care for others. Why couldn't that be part of international law education? Well, I want to illustrate both forms of using aesthetics in thinking about international law from Philip Allitt's book, Eunomia. I think it incorporates both categories. It's a work of beauty. It incorporates in its language beauty. It's got, I'm going to read a passage that I think has some lovely symmetry that I find very powerful and attractive. But it also works to do exactly what that peace education idea is, to present a world, to think about a world that international law can create, that is a world we want to have, a world of human dignity and flourishing of nature. So here's the one small quote I chose for our last moment or two, so I can read it well. So I should read this beautifully. Eunomia offers an idealist philosophy in the sense that it supposes that the human mind can find within itself the idea of a better human future and can choose to make a better human future actual. It assumes that social philosophy can be formulated in such a way that society can identify and enact the particular form of idea which has traditionally contained in the actuality of society, a better potentiality, which is capable of dominating all the processes of society, including the making, the application, and the enforcement of law. To pursue the ideal is necessarily and intentionally to oppose the tyranny of the actual. Idealism is not the realism of the actual, but the realism of the possible. The ideal of a better future is the possibility of a better human future. The two last sentences, what beautiful symmetry. So I could end there, but I can't resist Ellie not ending with a quote from Sir Hirsch Lauterpach that I find very much in sync, parallel, symmetrical with that idea we just heard from Eunomia. Sir Hirsch wrote of Grotius's understanding of what impels human action, and he said, "It is the desire for society, not for society of any sort, but for peaceful and organized life according to the measure of our intelligence." And that is the end of the lectures.
Remains for me to say a few words of thanks to Mary Ellen for actually introducing, I think myself, perhaps many others, to a world of international law with which we were not previously familiar. It's been a very stimulating lecture, a provocative, full of